Contextualizing Coke 30 and remembering Jameel Abdullah Alamin. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show, Muizam Tali. The music in the background is Water No Get Enemy by Fela Kuti. The first part of Africa Now today is a focus on the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, which took place in Belém, Brazil. The conference was scheduled from November 10 until November 20, and it was the 30th annual meeting of the Conference of the Parties, or COP 30. Of the 1992 UN Climate Agreement, that's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. The agreement was put in force in 1994, 31 years ago this year. COP 30 conference ended a day later than scheduled. At the end, the Global South was able to have, in the final agreement, tripled the funds in adapting its infrastructure to handle the impacts of extreme weather, but those funds will not be fully in until 2035. The final agreement also stated that the phase-out of fossil fuels will be voluntary, with countries putting in place their own roadmap for that initiative. Many environmental activists saw this as a setback in the climate change struggle. To begin the process of unpacking COP 30, yesterday I had a brief conversation with Muthika Mwenda, who is the executive director and co-founder of Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, who is based in Nairobi. Muthika Mwenda contextualizes the recent annual climate conference, COP 30, looking at demands of those who are most impacted by climate change, the outcomes of COP 30, and more. Here is the conversation. Muthika Mwenda, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule, particularly as you're coming from COP 30. And I wanted just to start to give us the initial atmosphere at the beginning of COP 30.
Thank you very much. I'm just arrived in Nairobi from Belém. It has been a very long journey, and it was a very tough 2 weeks of negotiations, where, as usual, the COP 30 demonstrated the growing North-South tensions and a disagreement on critical issues of global concerns, including climate action. And the outcome there may not have been what we aspired anyway, but one thing it has certain was the importance of multilateralism. Aside from issues which we wanted really to be addressed, which I think, as I can say, we made some progress from the past. And the fact that the United States, for the first time, sat completely outside the COP, because, as you know, the Trump administration has pulled out from the Paris Agreement, and they have demonstrated that by excluding themselves from the negotiations. And this is actually very acute, because though in its first administration they pulled out, there is no other time they have ever boycotted the negotiations in a manner we saw this. But for us, we say it's good riddance, because in the absence of US, we were able to achieve what could have achieved, would not have achieved, because we have discovered that the U.S. plays a more obstructionist role in the negotiations than helping the global community to come up with the solution of the most serious issue to the survival of humankind and the survival of the planet than any other country. And so we believe that the world will move, whether with the U.S. or not. We are very progressive, though not what we ultimately require, because this is a give and take negotiations. But at the end of the day, we were able to overcome what Trump and predicted, that we may not be able to progress without the United States. So United States, in a nutshell, has excluded itself, has walked away from the community of nations. And this is not bad for US, but also for the global community.
So you're
what
saying
we
that
have demonstrated is that the world can do without US. It didn't at COP30, it also didn't in the G20 meeting in South Africa.
So you're saying that, sorry, I interrupted you for a minute there. So you're saying that the U.S. not being there was actually more, it gave more productivity, even though there was still some issues that need to be ironed out, but you felt, particularly you as a environmental activist from the African continent, you felt that having the U.S. not be part of this COP actually made it easier for some issues to be addressed, which when they were there were hindering some of those issues.
That is in my opinion.
And do you think that's a highly wide held view by other people who are involved in the COP30? At the beginning, did people have that 2 weeks ago when you were just starting, when you heard that the U.S. was not going to be there, was there a sense that this could actually be advantageous for dealing with the climate change issues?
Well, U.S. is the largest historical contributor to the greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, bearing the highest responsibility to address climate crisis. So their presence there is important. But if they exclude themselves, it's well and good. The world will not stop that because the United States has excluded itself. So it has always been there to obstruct because it wants to transfer its responsibility to the people, particularly in Africa, who have little to do with this crisis, but bearing the brunt of the climate change impacts. So in our view, and though silently, many delegates felt a sigh of relief and felt the U.S. Obstructionist would not be there.
And also, one of the things that we saw at the beginning of COP30 were reports that there were lobbyists from the lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry outnumbered even the environmental activists. How far true was that in your assessment, and how did it impact the proceedings?
Well, there are mixed reactions on the transition away from fossil fuels. We lacked that language, though there was reassurance from the presidency that they still will continue spearheading conversations around the subject, which was very emotive between the countries and the corporations which benefit from the fossil fuels, especially Saudi Arabia and those others. And so there still, we cannot ignore the influence of the oil producing and the fossil fuel countries and the corporations. They are resistant vehemently, and I can say the language which we got on this time round was a bit more weaker than what have been done, particularly in COP28, when there was a very clear language on the fossil fuel phase out. So this was actually a derailment. This was actually like going back, and whether this has been manifested by the fossil fuel countries, then that's the story for another day. But clearly, there is a long way to go. The presidency announced that it's going to pursue and work with others in driving the fossil fuel the conference on transitioning to from fossil fuels in Colombia. And we hope that will advance the discussion. But as far as we are concerned, as FACHA, we really need a lot of pressure, and countries and corporations are held this matter at abeyance.
And one of the things you said that I wanted to expand a bit more on the fossil fuel issues. One of the things that you said in the beginning was that this COP30 also showed that multilateralism matters and multilateralism is working, and that's something which Brazil was trying to achieve, the objective of achieving. And could you expand on how do you think that this COP showed that there is multilateralism is alive and well? And if you could expand on that, what you meant by that?
If you look at the current geopolitical landscape, many countries, especially from the north, are looking more inwards. They are becoming more nationalistic in almost all issues which require global cooperation in tackling. And the rise of the right-wing movement, and which I know you understand when I say that, in the US, the Trump, and those others in Europe and those others, who are supposed to take the lead, you see, they are looking more into their national interests than anything else. But in the face of all that, the ability to get to secure a collective decision, weak as it may have been, then is a victory for multilateralism. So that is what I'm saying. It may not, we may not have been able to secure quite what we desired on the fossil fuel phase out on adaptation and finance, but at the end of the day, a global compromise document, which is able to say we, the community of nations, are saying this, I think is a victory for multilateralism. And I think the world has agreed that no country, no individual, no region, no sector can walk away from multilateralism. There are issues which we may need to work together to address, especially climate action.
And again, that's Nthika Mwenda. He is executive director and co-founder of Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance. And we're speaking to him directly from Nairobi. And this is contextualizing the COP30. That's the Conference of the Parties, the annual environmental conference on climate change that takes place, which took place in Belém, Brazil, just ended over the weekend. And as we were talking from looking at how this conference has been proceeding in the past few years, as we mentioned, how the issue of fossil fuel industries and environmental the lobbyists being so much involved, the last two COPs have been in oil-producing countries. Do you think this has also been part of the reasons it's impacted the outcome of the process, that this not just the issue of not having a stronger language on phasing out the fossil fuel, but also partly because you've also had deep in the process the issue taking place, like in Azerbaijan last year, and of course in Dubai a couple years before in 2023. Do you think that's also has impacted this process? As you said, that it wasn't as what one would like, but do you think that's also impacted this process?
No, I think the issue of fossil fuel has not just started now. I think it is still a discussion evolving, and it is not going to be easy because some countries have different positions than others. So I think that's not a big deal. Yeah.
And you don't think that it's been also negatively impacted from, you know, the last few COPs, the COP 28 to 29 have been in oil producing countries?
No, I think we need conversation between those who produce. If you want to win a war, you have to address the people who are being affected by it. So being hosted by a country which produces, I think is the because we are discussing with them, it's a conversation. Their populations are impacted, and there are those who are impacted by their actions. There are those historical producing countries. So it's quite a complicated, it's a complex matter, and we need to see how this works in practice.
And as you're saying, one of the things that you may not have received all the things that you've were demanding. If you could give us some of the outline, briefly outline some of the expectations and demands by countries who are most impacted on climate change.
Come again? You know, I'm in a noisy place.
Oh, sorry. I was saying that, what were some of the expectations of countries that have been most impacted on climate change?
The country impacted, their desire is to see rapid, others want incremental phase out of fossil fuels. And there is actually a coalition of countries, around eight countries, most impacted, including the small island states, who want very radical, you know, phase out. Radical. When I mean radical, they want it to be like tomorrow. But realistically speaking, these other countries are saying, no, it is not possible. We need to win our economies out of that. This is the ones which create our jobs. This is what. So that is actually where the world is. So there are those, everyone agrees that we need to phase out, to move away, to transition away from fossil fuels. But how this is done, that is actually depends on individual countries and the context of countries. And that's why some countries were saying, let the phase out be based on national context. That if we produce country, you cannot give us timelines that by 2030 we are going to phase out. So what will cover the income lost, you know, the economy, all those. So there are so many considerations which are put And that's why there is actually a very big difference and disagreements in the COPs.
Could you give us what were the most important demands of the countries impacted by climate change, particularly the African countries? What were some of the most important demands that you were bringing to the table for COP?
I think I've shared a document for us. Actually, what I've shared generally reflects what Africa deserved. I talk about Africa. But the key demands is sufficient resources, that is in terms of money. We were talking about global goal and adaptation and its indicators, which really was very emotive. So we need really to fund adaptation, but we need to be able to know how it is happening in agriculture, in roads, in other sectors. So that one was very emotive, and I think we made progress on that. And there is the Belém and Addis Ababa vision on agreeing on some of the things. But we were saying, without even if we have goals, global goals on adaptation, without means of implementation, it's meaningless. Means of implementation means finance, which was really a big issue there. You know, the global community in COP29 adopted the Belém, Baku Belém roadmap for $1.3 trillion, but that was but agreed on $300 billion per year. That was not resolved, and so we are saying that we need money. So that's why. Number two, we need the just transition, which is responsive to realities of people in Africa. So that's very important. And also, we need technology transfer. We need to create jobs for young people, and so many and so forth. So there were many issues which I shared with you in the document which I sent you.
What would you say the impact, the role of countries like Saudi Arabia and China in the COP30?
No, each country and its position. I think their impact in Saudi Arabia, of course, pushes so hard against any decision on fossil fuel phase out, which is going to affect its economy, which is rapid. They even during the COP28, Houston is where we end even for the first time a mention of fossil fuel phase out. Yet they are very vocal when it comes to say we need radical phase out. So it is stands on the other side of countries which are saying we need timelines. So it needs longer timeline, so that it can win itself out of fossil fuel. And so that the influence, you cannot ignore. And remember, the Saudi Arabia is a friend of US. So there is the US, United States. So there is a connection there. Two, the China. China is actually now is the current global emission emitter due on its economy and the second economy in the world. Them, they feel that everything, all responsibility should not be pushed to them, whereas the U.S. has abdicated its responsibility. So these are the things which we have to address, and let us see how they are going.
That was a brief conversation with Mthika Mwenda, who is the executive director and co-founder of Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, who's based in Nairobi. Mthika Mwenda contextualized the recent annual climate change conference, COP30, looking at the demands of those countries most impacted by climate change, the outcomes of COP30, and more. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinwesa Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your Jazz and Justice station. Now Africa Now remembers freedom fighter Jameel Abdullah Alamin, formerly H. Rap Brown, who joined their ancestors on November 23rd. Featured is a portion of a show from our archives with writer Arun Kundanani. Arun Kundanani is a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. The conversation explores the political praxis of Jamil Al-Amin, the evolution of H. Rob Brown into Jamil Al-Amin. Provides a rich and vital lens through which we can understand the Black freedom movement in more ways than we can account for. Here is African Owl's executive producer and co-host James Pope with the conversation.
Articulated the sentiments of Black people was because SNCC had a public forum, not because I articulated the sentiments better than the brothers on the streets, brothers who didn't have that public forum. I don't think that you could articulate sentiments of Black people last year any better than they did in Detroit. So I think the movement is a leaderless movement, whereas we might influence people, we do not control people.
Well, how does this solidarity come about if there is no specific leader?
I think eventually there will. I think as the struggle progresses, you see, revolution does not occur in one stage. It's an evolutionary process, you know, like people go through different things. The masses of people become involved, then leaders are chosen. Right now, you have a vanguard struggle that's occurring, whereby groups are fighting about discussing political ideologies which are relevant, which should be incorporated into the struggle or will be incorporated into the struggle. That's not to be misinterpreted with, you know, like the revolution, because it's just a phase of evolution.
What about politics? Where do Black people fit into the political spectrum right now? Or should they at all?
Well, politics is defined by the geographical and influential spheres of this country. It's irrelevant to Black people, and it's irrelevant to the masses of people. The vote has been used as a tool of oppression against Black people. I mean, Camus raises a very good point when he says, what better way to enslave a man than give him the vote and call him free? It does not profit Black people or poor people anything to have the vote and not be able to select the candidates who they want to choose. Now, how can you choose between Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Agnew, Wallace, and Humphrey? There is no choice. Evil is evil. There's nothing in between that.
There was some lesser candidates, Dick Gregory running for office, Eldridge Cleaver.
I think the vote can only be used as a tool of organization. We can only use the vote to organize our people. Now, to really believe that we can put someone in office and that these people would be responsive to our needs is naive, politically naive. Because even if one of the Black candidates who ran for office were to take the office of president, then Black people must be prepared to fight against that person.
Why?
Because, you see, the system mandates the action of the individual. The individual does not determine how this country will function. This country works off the military-industrial complex, which means that it's profitable to wage war. And unless you, you know, devise another plan, another scheme to sustain, to boost this economy, then it's going to be necessary to wage war, whether, you know, a Black individual is in office or a white individual is in office. Well, so we're talking about a complete a change in system.
If Mr. Cleaver did win the election, don't you think that he could have conducted the presidency in a unique manner that may not be, you know, compromising to the system you speak of?
No, because, you, as I said, the system dictates the response of individuals. You see, individuals do not influence politically, economically, or socially. The attitude.
Individuals do not create rebellions. Conditions do. On August 31st, 1967, several thousand delegates gathered at the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago for the opening rally of the National Conference for New Politics, NCNP Convention. This event was an ambitious attempt to develop a broad coalition of over 200 different organizations that included the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Students for a Democratic Society, the Socialist Workers' Party, and the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy. According to Kundendani in The New Malcolm X, who was Jamil Al-Amin, the forgotten radical of the civil rights movement, on the opening night, Dr. King outlined an anti-capitalist politics that had become essential to his worldview. This, of course, has been erased from dominant discourses on Dr. King. For King, capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of Black slaves and continues to thrive on the exploitation of the poor, both Black and white, both here and abroad. The only solution, according to Dr. King, was a radical redistribution of political and economic power. Another key point to highlight was that there was talk at the convention of running King as an independent candidate of the left in the following year's presidential election. Despite the prominent role of King in SCLC, the leading Black organization at the NCNP convention was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee chaired by Jameel Alameen, then known as H. Rapp Brown. Born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Alameen worked with the civil rights movement in Alabama and Mississippi in the mid-1960s. He was only 23 years old when he was elected SNCC's national chair, 4 months before the NCNP convention. As he traveled the U.S. that summer, federal agents and informants constantly tailed him. In the month and a half before arriving in Chicago, he had been shot in the face with buckshot by a deputy sheriff and arrested twice on incitement to arson and riot in Maryland. A state attorney later admitted to fabricating the charges. And on firearms charges in Louisiana, these were voided on appeal when it emerged that the judge had announced at the state's Bar Association convention before the trial that, quote, "I'm going to get that N-word." A few days before the NCNP convention, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sent a memo to all of the Bureau's field offices instructing them to establish new secret, quote, counterintelligence endeavors to, quote, expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the activities of Black nationalist-type organizations and groupings. This did not exclude King's SCLC, and Jameel Alameen was one of four, quote, extremists mentioned by name in the memo. Over the next 3 months, the FBI sent to the White House an average of 2 memos a week describing Alameen's activities. Due to his innate ability to be very clear on identifying the objectives and mapping and presenting viable means to achieve these objectives, many begin to see Jameel Alameen, then H. Rapp Brown, in the tradition of Malcolm X. At a speech to the NCNP convention's Black Caucus, Alameen drew a grim picture of the situation facing Black America. Alameen argued that, quote, "America is putting into effect the genocide of Black people," and suggested that this was happening in 4 ways. First, Black people made up 1 in 3 of the U.S. deaths in the war in Vietnam, though they represented only 1 in 10 of the U.S. population. 2, huge numbers of Black children in the Deep South are dying each year of poverty. 3, Black people were being sent to prisons in the name of law and order. And 4, Black folk were being disproportionately targeted in the area of reproductive health. Alameen rejected the liberal narratives that the U.S. was on the verge of overcoming past legacies of racism. The racial advances that liberals celebrated in the 1960s were superficial, he argued. In fact, there was regress, not progress. The only way to stop this impending violence was by force. Jameel Alameen further argued that, quote, "violence against Black people perpetuated by both political parties and enabled by the repressive powers granted to the national security agencies was escalating because of economic changes. Quote, we were brought here as enslaved peoples to work. There is no more work. We are a problem to America. Now, the U.S. has, quote, a surplus of N-words. We have outlived our usefulness." In an interview a few weeks earlier, he told a French journalist that, quote, "the capitalistic system, as it is set up, cannot accommodate 40 or 50 million Black folk. We believe that this structure cannot be reformed." For H. Rapp Brown, quote, "racism in the United States was a system of carceral, economic, police, and military violence tied at this historical moment to a coming contradiction of capitalism's need for Black waged labor. To be deemed surplus to capitalism was, he suggested, to be vulnerable to mass incarceration or, quote, elimination." For Jameel Alameen, as he told the NCNP's Black Caucus in Chicago, it is essential to connect with other oppressed groups across the world in Puerto Rico, Vietnam, Africa, and Latin America. Quote, "we are a colony inside of America. Black people constitute a colony, an internal colony," he argued. Alameen's predecessor to SNCC's chair, Kwame Ture, then known as Stokely Carmichael, wrote that the slogan of Black power, which SNCC had adopted that the previous year, meant, quote, "that Black people see themselves as part of a new force, sometimes called the Third World." Some scholars, such as the historian Matthew Jacobson, described the NCNP convention as the moment when, quote, "identity politics was born." Nevertheless, it is without question that this conceptualization distorts Jameel Alameen's and other Black radical thinkers at the time idea of identity. Jamil Alamin wrote that it was necessary for Black people to begin to define your Black heritage in order to overcome the self-hatred inculcated by white superiority. But the definition of identity was the first stage in a process that had to go beyond cultural heritage to a radical politic. For Alamin, quote, we must move from Black awareness to revolutionary motion. The recognition or celebration of Black cultural identity is not necessarily anti-racist. To be Black is not to be revolutionary. When you begin to stress culture without politics, people could become so hooked up on the beauty of themselves that they have no desire to fight. It becomes ego gratifying just to be Black, end quote. The evolution of H. Rock Brown into Jamil Alamin provides a rich and vital lens through which we can understand the Black freedom movement in more ways than we can account for. Today, we present a recent conversation with Arun Kundandani where we explore the political praxis of Jamil Alamin. Arun Kundandani is a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. Born in London, he moved to New York in 2010 and now lives in Philadelphia. Kundandani is the author of What is Anti-Racism, published by Verso Books in 2023, The Muslims Are Coming, also published by Verso Books, and The End of Tolerance, published by Pluto Press, 2007, which was selected as a New Statesman Book of the Year. He has written for The Nation, The Guardian, The Washington Post, Vice, and The Intercept, to name a few outlets. Educated at Cambridge University, he holds a PhD from London Metropolitan University. He has been a scholar in residence at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and a former editor of Race and Class, the quarterly journal of the Institute of Race Relations in London. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Listen intently, think critically, act accordingly. Thank you for taking the time to join us today to have a very robust but wide-ranging conversation about some work that you're doing, specifically on one of our important political, social, cultural thinkers who is still with us.
Thanks for having me, Jack.
So let's dive right into the conversation, because what I want to do is really build an intellectual biography over, formerly known as H. Rock Brown. Let's talk a little bit about the work. How did you come to this particular project?
Yeah, I mean, the simple answer to the question is about 10 years ago, I wrote a book called The Muslims Are Coming, which was about the experiences of Muslims in the United States in the kind of war on terror period when, you know, they were experiencing a lot of targeting by the federal government and law enforcement agencies and so on. And it was about the what that looked like and the experiences that they were going through. And one of the stories that I looked at was the case of someone called Luqman Abdullah, who was an imam, Black Muslim in Detroit, who the FBI in the early 2000s, like wrongly suspected of being some kind of Islamic extremist, Al-Qaeda type of person. And they did their usual thing of putting, you know, informants into his organization and so on. It's kind of long story short, culminated in an FBI raid in which FBI agents shot and killed him in October 2009. And so I spent, you know, a good bit of time kind of investigating that story and writing about that for that book. And one of the strands to it that I didn't follow up at the time, but which I became aware of, was that the reason that the FBI originally targeted this guy was because he was part of an organization led by Imam Jamil Alamin. And I was aware that Jamil Alamin was formerly known as H. Rock Brown, and I was aware that H. Rock Brown was Black Power leader from the 1960s, but probably at that time, I wouldn't have been able to tell you anything more about him. And so then after that book came out, I thought, let me follow up on this strand. It might be quite interesting. And I went to Atlanta and met with Karima Alamin, who is his wife, going back to 1968. And I spent a few hours chatting with her, and it just became apparent that this is a remarkable thing, that this man currently in a federal prison, incarcerated since 2000 on, you know, as won't be surprising, on charges that don't really stand up when you look at them carefully, is not only like a significant figure in terms of the history of Muslims in the United States and was effectively, you know, one of the most important Muslim leaders during the 1990s in the US, and so has this kind of element that's about how Muslims have been criminalized and the war on terror and so on, but then also goes back to the Black Power movement of the late 60s, early 70s, and back then was a household name, you know, would have been on television, would have been one of the most prominent voices articulating that kind of revolutionary politics and experiencing the resulting repression as well. One of the four people named in the famous COINTELPRO memo that the FBI sent out in August 1967 as you know, one of the kind of radicals that they were most concerned about. And so it seemed to me that through this one person's story, you could connect together these different aspects of the, you know, the kind of history of the US going back to the 60s and through the 90s and into the war on terror. Unlike, you know, that if you think about the comparable figures from that period of the late 60s, early 70s, you know, obviously many of them were killed. Many of them were exiled. You know, Kwame Ture ends up spending the rest of his life in Africa. Many are, you know, in one way or another go wayward or become semi-respectable, you know, perhaps with jobs in academia or whatever. But he's one of the only ones that is still basically operating at street level, doing community organizing with a new framework, and kind of the Islamic framework that he applies is different from the Black Power framework, although it has some overlaps. But he's still doing that kind of work that he was trying to do from the 60s onwards. And that seemed unusual and remarkable. And you know, because he's in prison, that whole history has been erased, right? And his name's been more or less forgotten. All the kind of attention to the Black Power movement that we've seen recently, he doesn't really get mentioned in that. So it seemed that perhaps it would be, you know, I was amazed that no one's written a biography of him. No one was working on a biography of him. And I thought, okay, maybe I should give it a go and hopefully I can do this remarkable story justice.
So I wanted to pull in a strand here, because a strain of thought here. And I think I meant to say Jamil earlier, but, you know, the central figure, of course, we're talking about is Jamil Al-Amin, but also he represents a long tradition of resistance that stretches back, you know, specifically, you know, in the context of a Islam and Muslim resistance that stretches back a long historical, you know, period. You know, there was a number of resistance, particularly when we talk about, you know, the enslavement process, people kind of focus on the West African, but, you know, there was a North African and an East African. And of course, there was uprisings that was happening specifically in that particular region. So there's a long history here. Could you talk a little bit, you know, let's contextualize the person that we're talking about that's embodying this resistance, this long tradition of resistance, but using this framework and the evolution, because we see Malcolm X do the, you know, kind of, you know, the same thing. So we see this tradition of Islam being a very, very important framework that kind of sharpens the resistance in the Black liberation movement at a particular period. So let's talk a little bit about as much of that particular long tradition of Muslim resistance to enslavement, Muslim resistance in that particular context, and we'll move forward.
Yeah, so I think it's, you know, it's often forgotten that a good portion of the Africans who were enslaved and brought across the Atlantic were Muslims. And obviously, you know, Islam was prominent in West Africa and across the rest of Africa. So you know, there was certainly efforts in the plantation system to kind of erase that that cultural import from Africa, right? And in various ways, like resistance to that attempt to erase, right? So, for example, in Brazil, there is evidence of slave rebellions that are not only involving Muslims but actually organized through a kind of Islamic framework, right? So Islam becomes a means of a kind of ideology of resistance, at least in the Brazilian context, right? But that kind of Islamic force in among African Americans is kind of its hidden presence through the centuries until you get to the beginning of the 20th century, when you get various movements in Black communities that kind of embrace Islam. And I mean, that's a huge, there's a huge tapestry there of different elements to explore. Obviously, the notion of Islam is one part of that. But in fact, I mean, I think the majority of Muslims in the United States, you know, through the 20th century into the present day, the majority haven't actually been Nation of Islam followers, but various other kinds of strands to that that tapestry. And in relation to Jamil Al-Amin, the relevant part of this is a group called the Darul Islam, who emerged in Brooklyn through the 50s and 60s. And part of what's going on there is the you know, a kind of the circulation of preachers who've actually come from either South Asia or the Middle East in the, you know, New York City of the mid 20th century, and Black people finding something in the kind of religious and always implicitly, if not explicitly, political message that's circulating there, and then eventually appropriating that message to create their own Black Muslim congregations, imams, organizations, and so on, so that by the time H.R.A.P. Brown finds himself in the New York State prison system in 1971, and is looking at, you know, for the first time in his life, a relatively long stretch of imprisonment, and he is engaging with people who are already in prison, who are active with the Darul Islam, and he's persuaded to embrace Islam, and after he's out of prison in 76, he goes to Atlanta, settles down there, and becomes an imam, and builds a community within this Darul Islam movement. And you know, the Darul Islam is about you know, it's closer to the way Islam would be understood in the rest of the world compared to, say, the Nation of Islam. It's, in that sense, it's less heterodox. It's and it's a, essentially the argument that the participants are making at the time in this point in the 1970s is the, you know, the kind of Black revolution of the 1960s has ended up not achieving its kind of most revolutionary goals because it lacks a kind of spiritual core, and that's what Islam offers, right? And the idea would be that, you know, I mean, if you look around at the situation in the early 70s that Rap Brown is seeing, he's seeing, you know, members of his own organization being recruited as informants. He's seeing a kind of failure of loyalty, essentially, right? And he puts that down to the absence of his spiritual core, so that men can be co-opted by offers of money or offers of alleviation of various kinds by the system. And so he talks about, you know, what Islam does is it makes you co-intel pro-proof, right? It gives you this kind of inner strength that means that you can't be co-opted in that way that things like COINTELPRO try to do. And at the same time, its idea of what the revolution is going to look like, I think, is a much kind of longer term kind of picture, because it says that there's not only the external enemy of white supremacy or racial capitalism or imperialism, whatever it is, but there's also the internal enemy, right, of the ways that society has made you individualistic or having negative attitudes about your own history and identity and ancestry, or you know, making you not be able to create a kind of true kind of unified community with others, right? And so, you know, it's a need to work on that, on those kind of internal questions. Often, you know, and often the people that are being drawn into this are people who are struggling with things like addiction or have suffered various harms in their lives that have shaped their psychology in those kinds of ways. And so Islam, you know, I think that's what a lot of people are finding in Islam at this point, when so many Black Power activists turn to it in the early 70s, is this kind of way that it speaks to the inner core of who you are, as well as describing how you have these external enemies, you know, within the system itself.
That was a conversation between African Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope and writer Arun Kundanani. Arun Kundanani is a writer interested in race, Islamophobia, surveillance, political violence, and radicalism. That's from our archives of August 7th, 2024. And we play that to remember freedom fighter Jamil Abdullah Alamin, who joined the Ancestors on November 23rd. And again, the full conversation can be found on our SoundCloud page, and the show was on August 7, 2024. The music in the background is Ancestral Home by R. Carlos Nakai. And we play that Remembering Indigenous Peoples Month. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Sha'anana with Zain Alamin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting on issues concerning Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Gaimfi. And that's followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived in iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Koza and Fonangonda, and the Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. This Giving Tuesday, December 2nd, stand with the station that stands with the people. That's WPFW. Go to WPFWFM.org, click on the Donate Now button, and be part of the future of jazz and justice. WPFW, the people's station. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Many Rivers to Cross by Jimmy Cliff. Remembering Jimmy Cliff, who joined the Ancestors 2 days ago on November 24th. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
But I can't see For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, November 26th. Here are some headlines. The six Democratic members of Congress who recorded a video informing troops that they could refuse illegal orders are accusing the FBI of intimidation and harassment. The group said that the FBI had contacted the House and Senate sergeants at arms, requesting interviews with each of them. This comes after President Trump, our commander-in-chief, accused the lawmakers of seditious behavior, even though the Uniform Military Code of Justice states that service members can, in fact, refuse to obey an illegal order. This comes the same week that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth asked the Navy to review Senator Mark Kelly's comments in the video as potentially unlawful, and if found to be so, Kelly could face a court-martial. In more news, 20 Democratic states are suing the Department of Housing and Urban Development for failing to meet its obligations around unhoused people and for introducing discrimination into the process. WPFW's Noah Portner has this report.
The lawsuit revolves around the Continuum of Care program, which gives states money to settle unhoused people or those who have been left on the street after a disaster or domestic abuse. The Trump administration has slashed the amount of money for long-term housing and refuses to recognize transgender people in its activities. One of Trump's leading critics, New York Attorney General Letitia James, signed the lawsuit and said, quote, "These funds help keep tens of thousands of people from sleeping on the streets every night," end quote. The administration is using this money as leverage, refusing to disperse funds until localities create strict anti-homeless laws and accept only two genders. This funding argument isn't just a political battle. The safety of thousands and thousands of people rely on the Continuum of Care program as winter draws near.
In more news, the Trump administration has ordered a sweeping review of nearly 200,000 refugees admitted under President Biden, requiring many to undergo new interviews. Here again is WPFW's Noah Portner.
A leaked memo from United States Citizenship and Immigration Services argues Biden-era vetting was rushed and moves to re-interview refugees admitted during Biden's term in office. The review could ultimately strip some refugees of legal status, marking a major escalation in Trump's broader rollback of Biden-era immigration policy. These re-interviews will apply to refugees from areas such as Syria, the DRC, Afghanistan, and far more.
And this Thanksgiving season, a new campaign is saying it's time to put our money where our values are. It's called We Ain't Buying It. And from Thanksgiving Day to Cyber Monday, the campaign is asking consumers not to buy anything from Target, Amazon, or Home Depot as a way to send a message to major companies enabling the Trump administration. Earlier this week, Latasha Brown, a lead organizer, spoke with WPFW host Julianne Malvo.
We're reclaiming our power. We're going to be more conscious in recognizing that our dollars are part of a piece of power, mm-hmm. that our dollars, how we spend our money, right, also sends a message of what we believe and what we stand for. And so we're going to reclaim that power. The second thing is we're going to redirect our dollars.
The campaign urges consumers to support local and Black-owned businesses. And in D.C., there will be a solidarity picket on Saturday at the Target store in Columbia Heights that begins at 10 a.m. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Good afternoon, this is the Shai Rana Show with your host Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at wpfwfm.org and WBA.